outcome is anyone's guess. And we have long been taught that a warrior fights a warrior, not a mother and child, not a doctor or a patient, nor a journalist. A warrior does not bomb hospitals, aid workers, or food distribution centers, but it seems leadership in Tel Aviv never got that memo. This protracted Gaza genocide is the focus of this edition of your Spotlight. And now for our guests. Mr. Khaled Barakat, spokesperson at the Masar Badin movement, joining us from Beirut. Efahim Mohammed, broadcaster and commentator, joining us from London. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll do the gentlemanly thing, if we can, Mr. Khaled, and start with Ms. Fahima Mohammed there, joining us out of London. Fahima, winter, you very well know, is upon us. And while hungry Gaza families, they're huddling around open fires, many in shelters in the outside amidst the rubble with little hope for the future. What explanation do we, as the people of the world, have for Gazan families, why we have been unable to put an end to this nightmare for them?
Well, I guess we have to start by looking at it from a macro perspective rather than just the micro and the humanitarian disaster that is carrying on. And unfortunately, they are paying the heaviest price for the fact that Israel has failed to destroy Hamas. It has failed to destroy Hezbollah. It has failed to restore, it has failed to change the face of the region. It has also internationally image which has been destroyed. It is unstable internally, socially, economically, and institutionally, and its military has been humiliated. So this ongoing conflict will continue regardless of, even as you mentioned, of the international law and the humanitarian that we need to see, which would apply to majority of the world, but of course it does not apply for having any consequences for Israel crossing any red lines. There is no safe zone in the, you know, the Gaza Strip. There is no sort of rest for anyone. They have been displaced for weeks. Hospitals are not just the targets, schools and refugee camps, but now it's even the targeting of aid distribution, where you probably also have mentioned in your report that children have been killed while waiting for hours for food. And it's been many reports that children have been not just targeted because of the carpet bombing for these tents that have been put up in the winter where there's nothing else left for them to stay in, but also the children has been sniped in the head, the neck, and the chest. So with the Israeli sort of precision targeting, they unfortunately are unleashing their anger for the actual the point that they have failed in so many areas and have, you know, used up so much billions of dollars of the US. And now with Trump coming in January with his threat as well, they are doing the most damage that they can continuously day after day until that point, even though it's going to be where Trump will probably still make a deal in order to ensure Israel's security first and what they prefer, but at the same time for it to have some sort of, you know, pressure from the UN as well, for them to, you know, see that there are sort of humanitarian aid coming in, and the fact that there is huge public worldwide uproar that they need to do something, because at the end of the day, nothing seems to be working for Israel when it comes from their point of view of actually winning or achieving anything.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Khaled Barakat, thank you for your patience. Welcome to the program. Moments ago, I'm pretty well sure you're following the news, the Al-Mawasi camp was bombed by the Israelis. At least 20 Palestinians, many of them women and children, were killed, dozens wounded. This is just moments before this program started. Sir, tell us your initial thoughts on why still, after 425 days, every night, hungry Gazan families go to sleep not knowing if they're going to live through the night.
Yes, well, the Zionist regime want us to get used to this scene and that this is normal life for Palestinians in Gaza, and as if we have to accept this genocide, normalizing war crimes. And every day, as your coverage in press TV on a daily basis since October 7th, you have been also asking this question, is until when Israel is going to get away with all these crimes. Now the entire world knows about this. This is not news anymore in terms of what Israel is doing. The most important thing in my view is that why Israel could get away with all these crimes, who is behind Israel and this Zionist criminal regime. And that is, this genocide is taking place with the full support of the United States, France, Britain, Germany, and the Western, colonizing imperialist powers. It is also, Israel is getting away with these crimes because of the silence of the vast majority of the Muslim countries and Arab regimes, with the exception of the few, with the exception of Iran. The rest of these regimes are actually divided between, complicit in the crimes or not having the will to support the Palestinian people. And in this regard, Egypt comes in mind, because the Egyptian regime is both complicit and at the same time participating in the siege against the Palestinian people for the past two decades, especially these days. And the Egyptian regime is playing a role in assisting Israel in a way or another by not opening Rafah crossing, by not allowing aid and medicine, water to enter the Strip. Because what's happening is that Israel is slaughtering Palestinians who are being in prison when they can't leave Gaza, and they are constantly being bombed. And that's why even Israel allies cannot anymore justify these crimes. And as we know, the ICC, the International Criminal Court, have issued a warrant arrest against Netanyahu and Gallant, and also it's going to issue more warrants against Israeli, generals and politicians. Now, the international community have failed miserably in acting in a real way and in a responsible way. Gaza have exposed the balance of power that is guiding today global, balance of power. The United States wants to impose its own laws, and it has been blocking any real efforts in terms of stopping the genocide, whether it's Biden administration or the upcoming administration with Trump. It's not going to have any real change in terms of the United States imposing its hegemony over the region. But at the same time, we have to look at the other picture, and that is the steadfastness of the Palestinian people in Gaza and the Palestinian armed resistance, who until today is capable to stand against the Israeli war machine and making Israel objectives failing. Israel failed in terms of bringing Palestinians to surrender. They failed in terms of ending the resistance and Hamas and other resistance groups, and also Israel failed in terms of releasing the Israeli prisoners captured by the resistance. So Israel have been exposed and they failed. What they did is they killed and destroyed Gaza.
Thank you for your initial comments there, Mr. Barakat. Ms. Mohammed, I'm glad Mr. Barakat mentioned the U.S., and I'm particularly glad he mentioned Donald Trump, because just yesterday, U.S. President-elect Donald Trump made a serious threat. He said if Hamas doesn't release the hostages, there will be hell to pay. I want to know, what have Palestinians been paying then for the last 14 months with U.S. bombs, U.S. missiles, and U.S. basically made drones? raining down a nightmare on their heads, on Gazan families, for well over 14 months now?
Well, they're not going to look at it from that sort of perspective, unfortunately. We know that the Israeli lobbyist groups, not just in the US, but also in the UK and across the globe, has heavily influenced even the sort of political powers. And they also have a new cabinet that's upcoming that will definitely be even stronger in sort of stance for Israel. We have to obviously, you know, say it as it is, that Palestinians, unfortunately, are not looked upon as equal for anyone to give them that equal right. Even these sort of like, you know, humanitarian concerns that are out there from big organizations. And like I said before, for the rest of the world, that would apply, but it doesn't apply to the Palestinians. Even when there are, you know, hundreds of voters, it's one veto from the US. And that just says that they have another agenda, which is nothing to do with the people. And it seems like, you know, they don't really have any excuse but the fact that it is there to just make sure that Israel has, you know, the best of the best support in every way possible and excusing anything that they have done wrong. But even in Israel itself, we have the former Ministry of Defense actually stating that what's happening in Gaza is actually an ethnic cleansing. So their own people are uprising, and that's why they are very strict on even not allowing any journalists and not allowing, not just to also to say what's been happening in Gaza, but actually in Tel Aviv itself, its own journalists cannot actually say anything. One of its own press has also been told to, I think it was the Haaretz, that they were also held as limiting their kind of stories because they were posting things that was against Israel's sort of everyday dealings with regards to its military, as well as its Netanyahu, you know, dragging its feet and not actually even worrying about the hostages from the Israeli side. That's what they're saying. There are protests that are happening every day. There are many millions of people that have actually left Israel. There is no such thing as any sort of economic stability. In fact, it has gone so down that people are even scared to even be in the military. They are actually forcing even the extreme Orthodox Jews to actually partake in the military, which has never been before in history. So they are really suffering themselves, and they want to hide that. And obviously, looking outside from the West, they obviously have invested so much. So they have to continue with this to see themselves as a winner. Otherwise, their own country will have even more of an uproar because all of that would have gone to waste. So they cannot finish right now from their perspective unless they see what they feel that they can do, which is actually taking over, which is what Netanyahu stood up in the UN before even October the 7th with a map, actually not even having Gaza in the actual existence there. So they have, you know, their agendas, which has been mentioned. Yes, it is unfortunately that everyday people are paying the price for this in the most extreme way possible. And majority of it is children, women, elderly. They have, you know, reports every single day saying that, you know, they're hovering over them with regards to the military, whether it's the drones or the flights, the planes that are there, just, you know, not giving them even a peace to sleep. So there is psychological warfare. There is there to sort of break them down because they are very strong and they have been through this for generations and decades, but it's still no excuse for them to violate every single international law that there is and still get away with it.
And I'd like to put that same question to Mr. Barakat. When it comes to this threat by U.S. President-elect Donald Trump, there have been deals, there have been proposals, U.S. proposals, for a permanent ceasefire, for a captives release deal, but the Israelis refused to accept it. I mean, how's the onus on Palestinians, sir, at this point? Is the only deal that's acceptable to the leadership in Tel Aviv and in Washington is to have Palestinians basically give back the captives and lose control and ownership of Gaza?
Yeah, that's a very good question. But for us Palestinians, we feel that the Zionist regime is also paying a price and in its depleting, in its economic strength, its position in the region, its position worldwide, the image of Israel today and the nature of this Zionist colonialist regime has been exposed. Israel, in terms of its strategic position and goals, even in on the normalization front or being the hegemonic power in the region, is also in crisis. What we are witnessing is a regime who is living an existentialist crisis, not just administrating the war and the conflict with the Palestinian people and the region. And we see that when Israel launched its aggression against Lebanon, they realized that they were met with a very strong fierce resistance in Lebanon. And that's why they're trying to shuffle the cards. So, yes, things are happening in Gaza, but it's affecting the entire region. It's affecting Israel particularly, and not just the region. And, you know, when you look at the internal contradiction of the Israeli regime itself, you can see how they are divided. I don't see that the Palestinian people are divided. Palestinians across the board, they are behind their resistance, whether in Palestine or in the diaspora. Palestinians, the vast majority of Palestinians, support the resistance. And at the same time, yes, we are very angry and disappointed, but we're not demoralized, nor that we are going to just accept any deal that Trump will offer. The Israeli regime have to release our political prisoners. The Israeli troops and occupation forces have to leave Gaza and withdraw from Gaza. There is no chance that for Zionists to come back to Gaza and try to, have these dreams of Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and all these war criminals to be able to build settlements and colonies in Gaza. This will not happen. And the Palestinian people will not allow the Zionist regime to build settlements in Gaza. If you look at what happened in the last 14 months, the Palestinian people in Gaza did not leave Gaza, and they actually could, if they want to. They did it twice in the past, where they just stormed the borders between Egypt and Palestine. But our people are conscious that the Israeli objective that Israel is not declaring is the displacement of the Palestinian people. And they are doing this with the support of the United States. This is very important, and we cannot stress this enough, because the Palestinians are not just fighting Israel. The Palestinians are standing up against the NATO, against these Arab reactionary regimes. The Palestinian people are also not just fighting this powerful camp, they are also, even outside in the diaspora, they are being targeted daily by German police, by Canada's police. So it's not just Gaza, and it's not just the West Bank. The entire Palestinian people are engaged in this battle.
We're almost out of time. I want to get this last question out to Ms. Mohammed. Ms. Mohammed, just yesterday, 100 or earlier today, 157 countries joined a resolution in the General Assembly to organize a high-level conference aimed at creating an independent Palestinian state. There's only opposition from 8 members, the Israelis, the U.S., and a few of their cronies. Well, this resolution tells us two things: that most of the world, almost everyone in this world, believes that Palestinians deserve their own independent state. But more importantly, it also shows no one believes that Israel will ever give the Palestinians the right to self-determination, that they could be trusted to give the Palestinians their rights or their dignity that they deserve as a nation.
That may be true, but unfortunately, even with all of that, the reality is that the superpower, being the ally of Israel, the U.S., is too strong, and even if one veto, it does not go through, and we've seen that over and over again. So there is something that we need to understand, as much as the Palestinians have the resistance as a people, but even they are divided with regards to the political, whether it's the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, as well as Hamas in Gaza. And of course, you know, around the geopolitical areas as well, as we see in Syria at the moment, we have these different, you know, groups that have been rising up, which is also affiliated with the West and prompted by the West, actually trying to create sort of sectarian sort of divide. But it's not that. It's the fact that, you know, at the end of the day, like, you know, was mentioned before, you know, there is definitely sort of the fear of Israel not actually gaining what it actually wants. But they're trying in different areas and different movements. But unfortunately, the main powers and the main sort of players that actually do have control for making these decisions, including the Arab nation, has actually failed in the sense of actually, you know, standing by the Palestinians to actually make a difference, which they can, even if it was to actually, you know, punish Israel for, you know, certain ways of not giving them sort of, you know, sort of aid or whatever it means, or even doing deals that they are at the moment, even aiding them in any way with regards to their military bases and things like that. But that's continuous. So unfortunately, even with the hundreds of people that are there, even in the UK, Labour has said that they would even recognise the Palestinian state. But as soon as, you know, they came into power, that was refuted, and again, it was ignored. So when it comes to the major players who actually can make a difference, unfortunately, it won't be seen through.
Thank you both. Time has gotten the better of us. Well, appreciate having you both join us on the program this evening. Mr. Khaled Barakat there, spokesperson for Masar Badil Movement, joining us from Beirut, and Ms. Fahima Mohammed, broadcaster and commentator, joining us out of London. And this brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your Spotlight. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. This is To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. It's great to have all of you here, and today we want to talk about a character who not only influenced Muslims across the world, but influenced many non-Muslims as well. This great personality is the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. Imam Ali alayhi salam was brought up under the care of the Holy Prophet Muhammad when he was just a small child. And so in this manner, the foundation of the moral and spiritual education of this magnificently intelligent child was based by the Prophet of Islam himself, the greatest educator of all mankind. Imam Ali's mental faculties were to an extent that he believed in the Holy Prophet and his mission at the tender age of 8. Therefore, Imam Ali, contrary to the other companions of the Holy Prophet, had never worshipped idols and never partook in the unreasonable demands, the oppressive actions, or the unjust acts of the Arab chieftains. Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So when we're talking about this beautiful persona of His Eminence, the first divinely appointed Imam, the first divinely appointed successor to the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, of course, he was always the champion of Islam, but when we talk about him being the champion of Islam, we find that he was also the champion of Islam in the sense where he was always helping the believers. Now, whether this was on the battlefield or off the battlefield, in both situations, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam was helping the believers. On the battlefield, he was physically defending the believers from the strikes and the blows of the enemy. And when he was off of the battlefield, and of course we find that His Eminence was protecting the believers or helping the believers or helping the needy or helping the poor or helping widows, helping orphans. And any place and in every place that we look, we find that His Eminence Imam Ali alayhi salam was helping the people. And of course, this is something that is very important for us to follow, right? We find that, you know, there are so many traditions which talk about alleviating a fellow believer's anguish. And if one alleviates a fellow believer's anguish, that Allah will alleviate from that person the anguish of the hereafter, for example, or will bring that individual out of their grave with a very light and pure and clean heart. And so such great rewards and such great status and honor for an individual who alleviates the anguish and the pains and the sufferings of another believer. You know, we find in other traditions that we have been told that the blood of another believer is equal to our own blood. And so just as if we were to be sad when it comes to the death of our close or near relatives, we should feel that sadness for another believer. And of course, as we said, this is what we find in the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Now, connecting this to the present day, when we see that our Muslim brothers and sisters in places like Palestine or Lebanon or Syria or Iraq or Yemen or in different places of the world, when we see that they are suffering, that they are under oppression, that they are being repressed unjustly by powers or organizations or terrorists, we should feel that pain. And we should feel that anguish and that suffering that they are going through. And most importantly, we should try to find a way to help these people, even if it is as something as creating awareness or speaking about it in whatever platform we have access to, or, you know, doing something about it. Because not only will this result in great status and honor for ourselves, but it is the right thing to do to help our fellow Muslim brothers and sisters. A very beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: كل وعاء يضيق بما جعل فيه إلا وعاء العلم فإنه يتسع به.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "Every container gets narrower according to what is placed in it, except knowledge, which expands instead." ¶¶
we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
We all know the famous saying of the Prophet, accepted by all Muslims, where he says, "Ana madinatul ilm wa aliyun babuha," where the Prophet says, "I am the city of knowledge, and Ali is the gate to that city." If you want to have access to the knowledge that I have brought from Almighty God, you have to come through Ali. And this is something everyone accepts. But I would like to go to another aspect of his life and his virtue, his quality, his knowledge is concerned. But just about this hadith, one comment about it. If you look at the companions of the Prophet, there were some among them known for their knowledge also. But none could come even close to Ali. One of the prominent Sahabi of the Prophet is someone known as Abdullah ibn Abbas. Abdullah ibn Abbas is known among the Sunni historians as Hibrul Ummah. Hibrul Ummah means the ink of the Ummah, the Muslim community. And the word Hibr or ink reflects, you know, his knowledge. That he is the most, you know, learned person in the Muslim Ummah of the early days. But look at his statement about Ali. This Hibrul Ummah himself says that when I look at my knowledge and the knowledge of all the companions of the Prophet put together, and when I compare that with the knowledge of Ali, our knowledge is just one drop compared to seven oceans of Ali's knowledge. And so, you know, you can have many, many companions and Sahaba who are very learned, but don't compare them to Ali. They're all put together one drop in the seven oceans of the knowledge of Ali. You must have heard these words where, you know, people say, Ali used to say, "Saluni, saluni, qabla an tafquduni." Where Ali used to say that, ask me before you miss me. Or ask me before you lose me, before I, you know, pass away from this dunya. Now, we know that Ali had mentioned this. And this was a challenge that Ali put to the Ummah. Whatever you want to know, ask me and I'll give you the answer. In looking into it, you know, Allama Majlisi in his Bihar al-Anwar has really served us in great way, and we appreciate his hard work, that he has put different incidences in the life of Ali where Amir al-Mu'mineen put this challenge to the people by saying, "Saluni, saluni, qabla an tafqiduni." It didn't happen only once. From what I was able to gather, 4 to 5 different cases where Ali has stood up and he has challenged the people, "Saluni, saluni, ask me whatever you want to ask me and I'll respond to you." But this claim or this challenge of saying, "Ask me," nobody can dare to say that unless he's sure about his own knowledge. And nobody before Ali made that claim. And nobody made this claim but that he was humiliated after Ali. In one of those instances, Ali says, "Saluni, saluni, qabla an tafqiduni, fa'ana la us'alu an shay'in dunna al-arsh illa ajabtu fihi." He says, "Ask me. There is not a single question under the throne of Almighty God in the whole universe that I will not be able to answer." Not only that, then he says, "لا يقولها بعدي إلا مدعٍ أو كذاب مفتر." And nobody can make this claim that I am making, anyone after me, unless he is an imposter and a liar. There were people, Muslim historians actually have given the names of individuals like Ibrahim bin Hisham, Maqatil bin Sulaiman, and Qatada, who actually dared to make that claim. And in all cases, they were humiliated because they were not able to respond to the questions that people put to them. And so when you hear about the statement of Ali, "Saluni, saluni," this is a unique challenge that Ali, you know, put there in front of the Ummah, which only he responded to and nobody else responded. Thank you.
this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Aminullah along with its English translations. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم فاستجب دعائي واقبل ثنائي واجمع بيني وبين أوليائي بحق محمد.
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan, and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my master and my Lord. Welcome my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the folly, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
إنك على كل شيء قدير.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, To My Brother. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
They too deserve an end to the fighting.
With less than 2 months before he leaves office, United States President Joe Biden is expected to flood Ukraine with over $7 billion in more weapons.
President Biden directed me to oversee a massive surge in the military equipment that we are delivering to Ukraine so that we have spent every dollar that Congress has appropriated to us.
In a move denounced by human rights groups, the first tranche of the largest weapons package in 7 months includes landmines, which were banned in a treaty signed in 1997 by over 160 nations, including Ukraine. Washington has crossed so many of their own alleged red lines that the Biden administration was forced to clarify that the latest shipment will not hand Kiev nuclear weapons.
It seems as though Biden feels emboldened and that since the election is over, there's really no check on his power. So he's using this lame duck moment to continually add fire to the flames in Ukraine now with the unrestrained use of landmines, the use of long-range missiles deep into Russia. Bringing the escalation ladder to a pitch that we haven't seen yet, and you know we always wish that we had never had to see.
Analysts say that Biden wants to ship in as many weapons as possible before Donald Trump comes into office in January, as he has been a vocal critic of the vast military aid for Kiev.
Trump has made belligerent threats to Russia, but also promised to end the conflict on his first day in office, making the incoming administration's foreign policy difficult to guess. What the latest announcement appears to make certain is that Biden's legacy will be one of exacerbating the bloody conflict between Russia and Ukraine instead of furthering diplomacy.
I think that with all of this, we have to just remember that how it started was Blinken and Biden admitted essentially that they knew that it would lead to this level of confrontation. And chose to keep saying, you know, we're not coming to the table, we're not negotiating. You know, it's similar to Rumsfeld and Cheney saying we don't negotiate with terrorists, but now they don't even negotiate with sovereign states. So it's madness.
Since February 2022, Biden has sent some $185 billion to Ukraine. Despite the vast weapons transfers and the marshaling of NATO, Biden is leaving office with Russia stronger than ever on the battlefield and with unprecedented demands, both domestically and abroad, to push Kiev to peace talks. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The Committee for Supporting the Arab People in Lebanon and Palestine. A speech festival highlighted the urgency of confronting the U.S.-Israeli aggressions and addressed the ongoing violations in Gaza and Lebanon. Speakers underscored the critical need to support the resistance as the only means of countering the U.S.-Israeli atrocities.
This festival is organized by the Popular Committee in support of the Palestinian and Lebanese people. Its aims are twofold. First, to celebrate the victory of the Lebanese resistance in thwarting the plans of the Israeli regime. And second, to reaffirm our unwavering support for and solidarity with the Palestinian people and the resistance in Gaza as grassroots movements.
The speakers underscored that through steadfastness and resilience, the U.S.-Israeli schemes can be nullified. They commended the resilience of the resistance fighters in Gaza and Lebanon, while condemning Israeli violations and calling out a global silence on the ongoing genocide in Palestine and aggression against Lebanon.
The heroic Palestinian and Lebanese resistance movements have succeeded in halting their plans for a new West Asia and thwarted Netanyahu's plans, who has long sought to reshape the region and redraw its borders. This was stated in his recent speech before the United Nations. We believe that the steadfastness of the Palestinian people and their courageous resistance over more than 14 months of genocide in Gaza, coupled with the support from the Lebanese resistance for the Palestinian cause, has effectively dismantled all Israeli schemes in the region.
We are here at the invitation of the Popular Committee to support the resistance and the resilience of the Palestinian and Lebanese people in the face of this unjust aggression. We strongly believe that words, actions, and grassroots movements are vital to overcoming this struggle. We are here to keep this cause alive until the liberation of Palestine and the triumph of the resistance.
The participants called on Arab countries to reconsider their relations with Israel, revoke their agreements with the regime, and continue supporting the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the resilience of the Palestinian people in Gaza. Participants emphasized that the events in Gaza and Lebanon are not isolated incidents, but part of a broader U.S.-Israeli strategy. They asserted that resistance is the only effective way to confront this agenda. Zeid Agarbe, Amman.
The actions of the leader of a Franco-Israeli organization blocking trucks carrying humanitarian aid for the besieged civilians in Gaza have been widely condemned. Nili Nauri Kupfer, who heads up the Israel Is Forever Association, is one individual specifically named in the civil suit for complicity in genocide.
They are putting on internet videos showing how they're starving the population in Gaza. So, because they are also French, we have the possibility to sue them, and we put a complaint against them.
Those people are an accomplice to the genocidal Israeli behavior towards the population of Gaza.
The NGO said it was crucial that those who supported these actions, including French nationals, be held accountable for their roles. At a rally this weekend, members of the Euro-Palestine NGO also expressed satisfaction at the arrest warrants issued by international justice against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former defense minister, Yoav Gallant. Both men are accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity. However, some observers say that any legal proceedings will likely prove purely symbolic.
Not only Netanyahu and Gallant must be afraid if they visit a number of countries who are part of the International Criminal Court, but also everybody who is complicit with them can be sued. And they must. This is a very important warning. It's not just symbolic.
Justice in such cases moves notoriously slowly.
As lawyers prepare for a court case that may be months away, the relentless destruction of civilians and the infrastructure in Gaza continues, with no sign of a ceasefire in sight. Peter Hume, Paris.
The southern Iranian island of Kish has played host to a grand conference celebrating Iran's National Navy Day, a day to honor the Navy's martyrs and commend its achievements, including the full construction of advanced vessels like the Jamaran and Denov frigates. The event also underscored Iran's diplomatic ties with regional nations, with top military and diplomatic officials in attendance, including representatives from Russia and Oman, along with military attaches from 24 other countries. Addressing the audience, Commander of the Iranian Navy, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, emphasized the strategic role of the Persian Gulf as a hub for peace and friendship.
Naval diplomacy is one of the key responsibilities of naval forces worldwide. We take pride in prioritizing the development of maritime diplomacy and fostering cooperation with the naval forces of friendly, neighboring, and brotherly nations, leaving no effort spared in this pursuit.
The Navy Chief also emphasized playing an active role in joint regional naval exercises, educational exchanges, operational collaborations, maritime conferences, and even sports competitions. These efforts, as he explained, have been pivotal in fostering mutual understanding and regional stability, a view echoed by Peter Rosenberg, the representative of foreign military attaches in Iran.
It is a diplomacy and dialogue which is the most important to communicate with another regional players, not weapons, but only diplomacy. And diplomacy can assure that you can have your interest assured, but diplomacy must be supported by the strong army and navy. And this is Iranian Navy which is doing this.
In line with these viewpoints, Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi also underscored the strong collaboration between Iran's diplomatic and military institutions. He praised the synergy between the country's armed forces and its diplomats as a cornerstone of Iran's strategic resilience.
The armed forces and diplomats complement each other on the international stage, with diplomats relying on field power as their backbone, at the forefront of which are the armed forces. In the highly volatile conditions of the region, Iran's diplomacy operates in full coordination with its armed forces, and this synergy has demonstrated its benefits effectively so far.
That is why this year, National Navy Day served as an opportunity to showcase Iran's naval strength with a fleet of missile boats, frigates, and submarines, all indigenously built. The display symbolized not just technical advancement, but also Iran's growing self-reliance in maritime security.
Iran's Grand Naval Parade showcases its growing capabilities in securing the Persian Gulf waters, a development that signals the dawn of a new era. As regional determination to stand independent of external forces grows, these advancements necessitate a re-evaluation of the presence of foreign powers in the area. Ali Ramezani, Kish Island.
Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi arrived in the Syrian capital Damascus on Sunday afternoon on an urgent visit after the recent developments in the Arab country. He was received at Damascus International Airport by an official delegation.
Throughout Syria's existential struggle against the Zionist entity and terrorism, we have stood side by side with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Today's visit by the Iranian Foreign Minister is part of our ongoing coordination and collaboration during this critical phase, as we are committed to victory alongside our friends, including Russians.
President Bashar al-Assad met with Araghchi and affirmed that the Syrian government, people and army will continue to fight with all firmness and determination to eradicate terrorism and eliminate it. Araghchi conveyed a message from the Iranian leadership confirming Iran's firm support for Syria in its fight against terrorism and its full readiness to provide all types of support, reiterating his country's commitment to the unity and stability of Syria.
This visit of the foreign minister of Iran is the visit in the exact time, and it came to assure to the all, to Syria first, and to all the people who don't trust that Iran is going to be exactly beside Syria in this war against the terrorism. And assure another thing, that this war is a part of the war of the Israelis against all the resistance all over the area, and Iran is going to be in the beside of the Syrian people as it was in the beside of the Lebanese or Palestinian people.
After his visit to Damascus, Araghchi will go to Ankara to discuss ways to find an acceptable solution to the current situation in Syria as part of Iran's diplomatic efforts. Analysts believe that the current diplomatic movement echoes the military situation on the ground, which will be determined by the Syrian Arab Army and its allies.
While the world remains mute spectator to the resurgence of terrorism in Syria, Araghchi's visit comes at this critical time as part of Iran's diplomatic efforts to resolve the crisis in Syria and to reaffirm Tehran's unwavering support for Damascus. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Tensions in Syria have erupted once again as Aleppo becomes the latest flashpoint in the ongoing war. Turkey-backed militants, along with al-Qaeda-affiliated groups, launched an all-out attack on the city, shattering a fragile period of relative calm. The Syrian army says Nusra Front terrorists, supported by thousands of foreign mercenaries and accompanied by heavy weapons and drones, launched the attack from multiple fronts. According to the statement, the Syrian army is strengthening its defense lines and is preparing for a counterattack against them. A coalition of groups, including Tekfiri and al-Qaeda-linked terrorists, launched their coordinated attacks on Aleppo and Idlib provinces on Wednesday. Syrian Foreign Minister Bassam Sabah says the attacks come within the framework of serving the goals of the Israeli occupation entity and its sponsors. He pointed to Israel's role in sponsoring terrorist groups such as Hayat Tahrir al-Sham in Syria, noting that Damascus has always warned of the obvious coincidence between the Israeli regime's airstrikes on government-held areas and the subsequent attacks of terrorist groups. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has at times voiced support for anti-Syrian government terrorists. In 2014, he even paid a visit to a field hospital established in occupied Golan Heights to treat wounded militants. Turkey has also played a significant role in supporting these groups. From the beginning of the war, Ankara has been training and arming anti-Damascus groups and provided them with a base for their operations. It later launched direct attack on Syria, which resulted in the occupation of parts of northern Syria that has been going on since August 2016. The war in Syria erupted in 2011. Many believe that the foreign support for anti-Damascus groups has been the main reason why the conflict has not ended yet, after more than a decade. Syria is regarded as the forefront of what has come to be called the axis of resistance against Israel in West Asia. And now it seems that after the failure of the U.S. and Israel in Gaza and Lebanon, they plan to further undermine and destabilize the regional security to cover up further defeats.
A solemn ceremony to bid farewell to a national hero. A loss that underscores the continued sacrifices made by Iranian military advisors in the region as they maintain peace and stability in the face of threats from terrorist groups. Martyred in Aleppo last week, senior IRGC commander Brigadier General Kayumars Pur Hashemi played a vital role in assisting Syrian forces, serving as a military advisor.
Martyr Pur Hashemi was a brave and dedicated commander, a symbol of sacrifice. His martyrdom is a reminder of the unyielding commitment we have to support Syria in its struggle against foreign-backed terrorists. Despite these attacks, we remain resolute in our mission.
Martyr Pur Hashemi lost his life in Aleppo during a large-scale assault by foreign-backed terrorists targeting Syrian military positions. This attack, reportedly carried out by the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham group, marked a significant escalation in the ongoing conflict in Syria, making the fight against them and the presence of Iranian military advisors even more crucial. Martyr Pur Hashemi's son, feeling proud despite the loss.
I am grateful to God that my father achieved what he always wished for, to sacrifice his life in the righteous path. My father believed in defending the innocent and fighting terrorism wherever it existed. Losing him is painful, but I take great pride in knowing that his sacrifice has helped bring peace to many. I always remember how committed he was to the resistance. He was fighting for his country and for Syria, aiming for the region to be peaceful. His legacy will continue through the strength of the Iranian forces and the Syrian people.
General Pur Hashemi's martyrdom comes amid ongoing efforts by Iran to support Syria in its fight against terrorism. Since 2011, Iran has maintained an advisory mission in Syria at the request of the Syrian government. The Iranian military advisors have been instrumental in assisting Syrian forces reclaim territory and restore security.
Martyr Pur Hashemi was not only a great warrior, but also a true man. At a time when our enemies tried to weaken the resistance, he stood firm and sacrificed his life. His blood will not be in vain.
As the country mourns the loss of this brave commander, Iranians remain firm in their support for Syria, signaling that this tragedy will not deter their commitment to regional peace and security.
Martyr Kayumars Pur Hashem was not the first, and he will not be the last, as Iran remains steadfast in its support for Syria. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the aversion for death. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab. So I'm talking to you today about the topic of aversion for death. So it's in a sense, it's a very difficult topic. It's a big topic. And so I'm just going to offer you a few different pointers here, a few different thoughts. So obviously, as Muslims, we do not have this sort of aversion for death, presumably or normally, that maybe are non-Muslims, non-believers, people of no deen of any kind have. So it's said that in our original fitrah, in our original and God-given innate nature, For example, we love life and survival. We hate death and extinction. So that's the way human beings are created. Obviously, we're in this material world and we make use of it. And there are things in it that we enjoy and we love. We love to take part in it and enjoy all the blessings. But obviously, we also have the innate tendency towards monotheism, towards understanding that there is one God. And we do understand also from the world around us that, you know, there are cycles, there are patterns in creation. This is the way it works. So